This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Inside Story on BFM 89.9.
Good evening. This is Inside Story with Sharmila Ganesan and Lee Chui Lin. Tonight, the results from the first ever Women's Tribunal in Malaysia.
So first, we're going to hear about the findings themselves and the witness testimonies that were shared. And then we look at what's next. What's up ahead?
So tell us, what are the biggest issues facing women in Malaysia? You can call 7733 2900, WhatsApp 018-789-8899, tweet us at BFM Radio. This is Inside Story. It is coming up to 6:08, and basically the Women's Tribunal Malaysia 2021 happened a couple of weeks ago, from the 27th and 28th of November, and it aimed to gather testimonies from affected persons and present them to a panel of judges made up of Mary Shanti Dairiam, Zaina Anwar, and Nadia Maliana. But I think it's worth looking at what the idea behind this Women's Tribunal was in the first place.
Yes, so a tribunal, in a traditional sense anyway, is a body that is established to settle specific types of disputes, as opposed to a court, which we'll see and hear all sorts of cases. And what the tribunal's aiming to do in general is that it hears evidence from parties, it reaches a binding decision in relation to what they hear. The decisions are usually reached by a panel of tribunal members rather than by one lone judge. And that structure and format is more or less what took place in the Women's Tribunal Malaysia 2021, in which affected women shared their personal stories of violation and discrimination, and then advocates took the floor to deliver presentations that would contextualize these stories within a legal, policy, and cultural framework. So I think just translating lived experiences into ideas of justice, right? Into understanding how it fits in into a larger societal picture. So in all, there were 26 witness testimonies and 9 advocate statements.
And this whole event actually consisted of a number of women's rights organizations and made up a part of the steering committee that led this. And that includes the All Women's Action Society, the Association for Women's Lawyers Malaysia, Persatuan Kesedaran Community Selangor, Tenaga Nita, as well as the Women's Aid Organization. And the main reason why the tribunal was convened this year was really as a response to the to our government ratifying the Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Discrimination Against Women, or CEDAW. And essentially, Malaysia made a binding commitment to respect, protect, and fulfill the rights of all women and girls. However, here we are, 26 years later. We have made some progress, but really, these people involved, these committees, they're saying that significant change towards achieving gender equality when it came to social, political, and economic spheres haven't yet been made. And this also means that we have 10 years to achieve that 2030 agenda for sustainable development. So a sort of midpoint, I think, to look at where Malaysia is and what more work needs to be done.
So we spoke earlier about setting these stories against a larger societal picture, right? And that's exactly, you know, the idea of the convention, as well as looking at where we are in terms of sustainable development. And I think I love that you brought up CEDAW, or that that's the backdrop for this, because Malaysia and conventions have a very fraught relationship. At best, we ratify them, and then that's almost kind of it. Whenever we check in on it, or when there are things that need to be done, it's sort of played up for a bit, and then it kind of goes away again. So CEDAW is something that gets brought up from time to time, when we say, well, we ratified it, and therefore we have these things in place. But then when we look at how effective it's actually been on the ground, it's very questionable. And then if you look at how we've behaved in relation to conventions more recently, we just don't ratify. So I think it's important to understand the backdrop against which the tribunal took place and what was shared, I think, and the findings. I'm really intrigued by that.
And those findings, I think, are actually one of the most important outcomes from this tribunal. So on Saturday, the 4th of December, after 1 week of deliberating on the testimonies and the stories that they heard, the judges of the Women's Tribunal Malaysia presented their findings and recommendations. That's what we're going to be looking at after this. We're going to try and understand what the outcomes were and what that might mean. And also, I guess, what's next? What do we need to put in place to work on reaching that that what seems like an insurmountable platform of equality, right, on all spheres? We would like to hear from you. What are the biggest issues facing women in Malaysia? You can call 7733 2900, WhatsApp 018-789-8899, tweet us at BFM Radio. After this, we'll be joined by Mary Shanti Dairiam, who was one of the judges at the Women's Tribunal Malaysia. So keep it here on Inside Story, BFM 89.9.
Beyond Frivolous Matters, BFM 89.9, The Business Station.
It is 6:15. You're listening to Inside Story with Sharmila and Lynn. And today we're looking at the Women's Tribunal Malaysia, the first time that has been held here. Specifically, we're focusing on the outcomes, the recommendations and findings that have come out of it. So we'd like to hear from you. What are the biggest issues facing women in Malaysia? You can call 7733 2900, WhatsApp 018-789-8899, tweet us at BFM Radio. Joining us now is Mary Shanti Dairiam, who was a judge at the Women's Tribunal. She's also founding director of the International Women's Rights Action Watch Asia Pacific. Shanti, thank you for being with us today. So the findings from the Women's Tribunal, they were announced over the weekend. Could you walk us through some of the biggest takeaways for you?
Okay. This was a tremendous experience for me. I worked on women's rights for so long, but sitting and listening to 26 women was mind-blowing, really. And there were several takeaways. First of all, the Malaysian Constitution guarantees equality and non-discrimination, but for these women, and fundamental freedoms as well, but for these women, equality or non-discrimination has not enabled them to exercise their right to equality, regardless of the Constitution. That was one. The other thing is part two of the Constitution guarantees fundamental freedoms, but these freedoms cannot be enjoyed in isolation. They are interrelated. Economic and social rights and cultural rights and civil and political rights are interrelated. And the violation in one area is going to create violations in all the other areas. And this is not yet recognized in Malaysia. That's the other thing. The other takeaway that I really want to mention is that where violence is concerned, we hear many stories of violence against women, and there's been so much awareness of violence in the country. We have laws in the penal code and the domestic violence law. All these programs cannot help women adequately if the police do not do their function. The police are of primary importance. They are the frontliners. Women go to them first when there is a violence against them and it's an offense. I don't know if you've suffered abuse, but if the police disregard their complaints, belittle them, which many of the women talked about, and blame them, and sometimes even take the stand of, you asked for it, you know, then nothing moves further, even though you have beautiful programs waiting for you. But it won't go beyond that. There's no further action. That's the other thing. The third thing that I took away was regarding development, poverty, eradication. Malaysia is more and more privatized in many of its economic activities. Private sector is playing a great big role. And if the private sector is only motivated by profiteering, then there is exploitation of the labor of women in many of the cases. We saw this in the hospital cleaners who've been totally violated and exploited. We saw also the issue of domestic workers, and the state government does not intervene as it should. Sometimes even the government-linked companies are the ones who are violating the rights, economic rights of women. And there is also, the government does poverty eradication, but it's doing this, it's not strategic. There is intergenerational poverty among a whole lot of people on the ground there, and women in particular. And intergenerational poverty pushes them into child marriage, early marriage, frequent pregnancies, a whole lot of deprivations, intergenerational deprivations. If poverty eradication only looks at putting income generating, it's not just a poverty of lack of income. It's a question of poverty of many other things. Poverty is multidimensional. So it's not strategic. Our poverty eradication programs are definitely not strategic. And the other thing is this violence in the workplace, in particular, that the testimonies that came to us are of young women who are harassed and who are denied many opportunities in the work for upward mobility, primarily in our view as judges, primarily because they are young and they are professional and they are capable, and the workplace culture doesn't appreciate young women who are competing almost professionally and who are entering male spheres of professionalism. There's much hostility towards that. And violence is sexualized. The harassment that takes place belittles, body shames them, threatens them with doing indecent things to them. It's very sexualized in many public violence, especially the harassment is sexualized. These are all things that came to us and really created great anxiety for us as we listened. These are the main takeaways, really.
And what was the role of the judges in all this? I mean, talk to us about how you arrived at the findings.
Okay. When we heard all these experiences of women, and very diversified experiences of women, we put together a framework for analysis of their stories, because the women are just telling us their stories, their suffering, you know. So we analyzed that and we put together a framework for that analysis. While we heard of the agonizing stories of their experiences, we broke that down into what rights have they been denied. And we looked at the rights. It was the right to equality, the right to be to dignity, to fairness and justice. Several rights came out. And then we looked at the next point that we looked at was what standards were had not adhered to. National legal standards, what are the standards not adhered to when these rights were denied to women? And the third point we looked at was, how did the state fail? What action should the state have taken and it did not? Or even just intensified the problem in some instances. So the failure of the state was the other point for analysis. And therefore then with these three points, we then said, what should we recommend? And that our recommendations were based on this analysis. This is how we came up with our findings and recommendations.
So how does the tribunal aim to deliver justice, even though these findings aren't actually legally binding?
Well, see, that is a big question. We have opened the lid and let out the genie, if I can put it that way. But the genie now has to be controlled. And therefore, we need to bring this to the attention of the government and cooperate with them and work with them and not just throw stones at them, but point out this is where it's failing women. Women's rights are not protected, fulfilled, and this is where this whole system is failing women. Every system that we have, it's not just the law, it's the law enforcement. you know, and the support that women should get, it's failing them. And therefore, let's work together on this. That's what we need to be doing next. Really keep highlighting the problem. For me, I was thinking, 26 women came to us, but we don't know how many more women are out there also experiencing these violations. So we have to do research as well. It's not just about these 26 women. There's a lot more happening out there. So we need to find out more. We need to get more information and more data and bring it to the attention of all the authorities concerned and offer to cooperate with them. That is what I would say. We need to bring justice. And women themselves must have more awareness. These 26 women, I have the greatest admiration for them. They came out and spoke and said, this is what is happening to me. And they were great awareness that their rights have been violated. That is why they came out to speak. But a lot of women keep quiet. They think it is their fate. I'm a woman. What else can I expect? That attitude must go. They are not aware of their rights. So women have to become more aware of their rights, and they have to come out and speak and open this up. So when all of this is done, maybe then we could see some change. Yeah.
You've had decades of experience pushing for legal and policy reforms for women's rights. Talk to us about how challenging it's been to push for this.
It's very, very challenging. First of all, I must say, looking at the activism that I have engaged in and women's groups, we have a strong, vibrant women's movement in this country, for sure. This whole tribunal itself was organized by the Joint Action Group for Gender Equality, a very vibrant group. And we've been doing this forever. The problem is, in my view, is that we are only looking at the substance of the law, and we're trying to bring about legal reform. But we have to look at the law much more holistically and comprehensively. We have to look at not only the substance of the law, but the culture of the law and the structures of the law. Even where there is, you know, first of all, substance of the law, sometimes the provisions of the law are inadequate. So the substance is missing in some instances. For example, we don't have a law on stalking. And stalking is, one of the witnesses spoke about the way she had been stalked for years by her ex-boyfriend, threatening her. But we don't have law to protect her. So there is a gap in the law. The substance is missing in some instances. But also, where the law has been good, the enforcement of the law, the implementation of the law is weak. And so there is a social cultural norm about women's rights, about women's equality, that prevents us, the country, from implementing and enforcing the law. The Constitution is guaranteeing equality. Why is it then that there is no equality for women? Because equality for women, society has not recognized and valued this equality. So therefore, even though the Constitution is guaranteeing you equality, it is not implemented. It's not used. That is not a framework for what we are doing. When we see these violations of these women, they are not being treated the same as men, men's rights. So that inequality is still there in the culture. So the law is not being enforced. So we have to do a lot more work bringing these elements of how is the law implemented, interpreted, and justice delivered, and what is the culture and the ideology. Society has to change. Sometimes if the social norms do not value equality, the law doesn't deliver, even if the law is there. Yeah? So there is societal norms. We have to go into much more holistic advocacy. And that is definitely very challenging.
Shanti, thanks for speaking with us today. That was Mary Shanti Dairiam, who was a judge at the Women's Tribunal, sharing with us their findings and recommendations. We'd like to hear from you. What are the biggest issues facing women in Malaysia? You can call 7733 2900, WhatsApp 018-789-8899, tweet us at BFM Radio.
Boleh for Malaysia. Ha. BFM 89.9, the business station.
It is 6:38. You're listening to Inside Story with Sharmila and Lynn. And today we're focusing on the Women's Tribunal, which happened 2 weeks ago. And the findings of them were just announced over the weekend. And we're basically looking at how that went, what the recommendations and findings were. And now we're going to be looking at what comes next, what happens post-tribunal, what to look forward to. We would like to hear from you. What are the biggest problems or issues facing women here in Malaysia? You can call 7733 2900, WhatsApp 018-789-8899, tweet us at BFM Radio. Joining us now is Ivy Josiah, who was a convener with the Women's Tribunal Malaysia. Ivy, welcome to the show.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
What expectations did you have putting together the Women's Tribunal, and were those expectations met?
Well, I think they were mostly met. We look at the objectives. I'm going to go through the objectives, so bear with me. So the first objective was to provide an alternative form of justice and advocacy. And we did that. We formed our own court. We put in place three judges. And collectively, we look at the judges. The oldest judge was in the early 80s. The youngest judge was in her mid-20s. And we about 100 years of experience in front of you. And the witnesses, you know, they took this court that we formed, this court of, you know, of public conscience seriously. And they felt that they were talking to actual judges, when in fact they were judges that we created. But we respected the experience, their wisdom, and we were not disappointed because their recommendations were tremendous. And the second objective was to ensure that we created a space to amplify the voices of diverse women. And you know, I think this is really special because at some point during the tribunal, you know, we started in January, right? And as we were plodding along and there were so many things to put into place and we need to publicize it, we held a clubhouse. And it was two women who represented the Women's Tribunal. One was from Sarawak and the other person was from Sabah. So we had Rusni and we had Grizel. And suddenly it occurred to us, isn't it amazing that two East Malaysians were holding the fort? And normally it is the Klang Valley activist type. No, there were two young women from East Malaysia who were talking to about 1,000 people, you know, on Clubhouse, about the tribunal. We had Orang Asli women. The advocate, Dr. Surya Angit, you know, herself, she's from the Temiar community, and she spoke so passionately about the testimonies. The testimonies were read by an Orang Asli young woman, too. And, you know, it really chilled me when she said, and then she talked about the racism and the discrimination the young Orang Asli girls felt when they went to school, when she said, why do we have to leave our Orang Asliness at home or at the school gate? And so I think we heard diverse voices for a change, different voices. So I think we did achieve that, not the usual Klang Valley types of activists. Sex worker. I mean, have we heard a sex worker in public talking about her experience, how she was, forced into sex work, how she remained in sex work, how she was abused, exploited, but couldn't have any access till now, sex workers, because they're criminalized for their work. You know, they don't have access to health services and other services. And we were able to platform a sex worker. And I think more than anything else, when we met the sex worker ourselves, when we met the transgender women ourselves, it was very important for them, you know. I didn't realize how important it was, but how much it meant to them that their voices were being platformed in what looks like a kind of a mainstream platform. Let me see. The other objective was to show gaps in law and policy. I think we did that. And, of course, to receive recommendations was another objective. Recommendations that we can use to hold the state accountable, to hold the government accountable. And now we have got 12 issue papers, you know, created, written by the judges and the advisors, and they are fantastic. The analysis is very good. The recommendations are sharp. The recommendations are both short-term and long-term, and we hope to, you know, translate these recommendations to Bahasa Malaysia too. And finally, the fifth objective was to build solidarity and strengthen movements. And I think we did that, right? I mean, we had all kinds of people involved. We had almost 100 people involved in implementing this tribunal, not only the tribunal proper, but also the arts festivals. So we had, you know, activists, ordinary artists, tech people, women's groups and other groups who normally do not work with the women's groups. So I do hope that we have sort of built or building a movement. I think I'll stop here. So the five objectives I feel have been met. But of course, you know, I initially wanted this whole tribunal to be in Bahasa Malaysia. But although we did have translations, the main language was still English, right? Mm. So somehow, you know, it fell back to English, yeah.
So with the findings and recommendations being released, what's the next step here?
Well, I think, first of all, you know, we need to make sure first the testimonies and all the recommendations, but the findings and the recommendations of the judges are copy edited and published. We're going to have an online publication, and it's going to take some time. That will probably be sometime in mid-January. But meanwhile, of course, we are releasing the findings, even though it's in a draft form. It's now up to the 14 women's organizations that organized this tribunal to take these recommendations and, you know, incorporate them into their own advocacy work in their respective organizations. Not only the 14 women's organizations, it can be, you know, Orang Asli groups, it can be transgender groups working on transgender rights, it can be, you know, it could be anyone, it can really be any NGO or any civil society group can take these recommendations and use it to advocate. On our part, of course, we want to present it to the Minister of Women. We are going to make an appointment because she seemed interested initially when we sent the invitation. By coincidence, one of our co-conveners, Mira Samandar, was at a meeting with Minister Rina Harun, and she handed the letter personally, and she showed interest. So hopefully she'll meet with us so that we can present her the recommendations. And as you know, we were very, very fortunate, and I think it was very astute and strategic on the part of the Deputy Minister in the Deputy Minister in the Prime Minister's Department, Dr. Mas Ermiyati, or she's known as Emmy, right? So Dr. Emmy did actually give us a closing speech. Couldn't attend it, but she was good enough to videotape it, and she actually made a commitment, right, Pramila? She said, the government is committed to introducing anti-stalking laws together with the stakeholders. Will be brought to the cabinet as early as December 2021 to be tabled in the Dewan Rakyat and Dewan Negara early next year. She made a commitment, you know, and I think I would like to think it's a win for us, because normally when we have these tribunals, and I've been involved in the People's Tribunals, in the Bersih People's Tribunal, no government officials turned up. But this time around, not only did we have a government official, we had a Human Rights Commission chair spoke, the CEDAW committee chair spoke. And so, yeah, we had quite a lot of attention from not only our government, but even UN officials.
We're speaking with Ivy Josiah, who is convener of the Women's Tribunal Malaysia. We'll pick up the conversation after this. But do send your thoughts our way. What are the biggest issues facing women in Malaysia? You can call 7733 2900, WhatsApp 018-789-8899, tweet us at BFM Radio.
Bringing fresh meaning. BFM 89.9.
It is 6:50. You're listening to Inside Story with Sharmila and Lynn. And we're closing off our conversation on the Women's Tribunal Malaysia by looking at what's ahead. And for that, we're joined by Ivy Josiah, who was a convener with the Women's Tribunal Malaysia. Ivy, what are you hoping the impact of these findings from the tribunal will be? How important are they when it comes to enacting change to existing policies that affect women?
Well, it's what you do with it, right? With the recommendations, as I said, the judges themselves, first of all their presentations and the recommendations were steeped in human rights language. And it's not just language. They related it back to the federal constitution, and they reminded not only the audience and the activists, civil society, but also reminded the state that you cannot pick and choose human rights. You cannot say, oh, we do not agree with sex work, so therefore a sex worker can be allowed to be beaten up. We do not agree with, giving complete rights to transgender women, but they can be allowed to be violated, or they can be subjected to violence. It was pointed out over and over again, the duty of the state, because they're very clear and spelling out the violations. So language was properly chosen. It was violations. It was not mistakes. It was not oversight. They are violations by the state, by the authorities. When it comes to workers, you cannot ignore workers' rights, because it goes back to the Constitution. It goes back to even the Employment Act. And they pointed out that whether it's the Constitution or whether the law, the state and the authorities were not delivering, were not protecting, were not creating a conducive environment in order to make sure that women are protected and their rights are secured. So I think, first of all, the impact would be that we accept the fact that we must approach, the government must approach any kind of human rights work, any kind of services when we work for women, we must have a human rights framework. And so I think at the end of the day, it would be what we can, how inventive we are going to be, how persuasive we're going to be in using these recommendations. Now, next year, 2022, the government has to report on their CEDAW recommendations. The government is obliged to head towards Geneva, and they must report to the CEDAW committee what they have done for women. What are they going to do for women within a human rights framework? And I hope that some of these findings, if not all of the findings, the analysis will be also be used. And I hope that even the government also looks at our recommendations and uses that kind of language, not only just language, but really, put a date to the implementation. They cannot just say, we'll look into it. I do hope that, not only the state, but civil society pays attention to it and be convinced that all of these rights are embedded in our constitution. And we have international obligations. We cannot choose to pick and choose what we want to do for women.
So what kinds of specific policies or change to policy are you hoping to see come out from this?
For instance, a very practical policy would be, do we have proper SOPs for authorities when it comes to the arrest of transgender women or sex workers? I mean, because when they came to give testimony, they did allege that they were being beaten up by authorities, right? Surely when you arrest a person, she may be committing a crime, inverted commas. I do not agree that being a transgender woman is a crime, but she may be committed a crime. But does that mean that she must be subjected to violence, for instance? So that there's got to be some SOPs, practical SOPs, to change the law to recognize transgender women as a person with rights. That may take a long time. but let's work on SOPs. Another important thing, for example, a policy change. The union workers, hostel union workers, we learned that the hostel union workers, because now they were, the hospitals have no longer, they were government servants, they were working for the hospital, and then they were terminated, and now they became contract workers. And then we find that they are contract workers for years. And the hospital is turning a blind eye. It's okay, they're contract workers. They don't get increments. They don't get social benefits. And they are basically, earning below, they're below the poverty line. There has to be a policy change. The hospitals and the GLCs who own these hospitals have to realize they have a duty. They cannot say, we did not hire the contract workers. They have a duty to make sure that that whoever they hired to get the cleaners must observe, must observe some labor standards. So I think we may not have big changes in the law. Certainly, there's going to be definitely anti-stalking law, a sexual harassment law. But in terms of policy, I'm hoping that there will be some policy change, there will be some awakening to say, let's change policy, the way we approach, workers, the way we approach that can be actually practical policy change. The way we do it, the processes can be better within a human rights framework that, that gives dignity. It shouldn't treat people with indignity. The union workers, the hostel union workers, was a real wake-up call for all of us. We did not realize how they were working. The contract gets renewed and they start from scratch. It's like you and I, every year we expect a raise, right? No, they don't expect a raise at all. They can't expect a raise because they're not given a raise. And that is exploitation. That is almost, it's modern slavery, really. So it's these things I think we can change. We can definitely change these policies. Does that make sense?
No, it does. It does. Ivy, we just have about a minute left. Are there plans to continue having women's tribunals or similar initiatives in the future?
After I sleep for 6 days, yeah. We were already thinking about it, that should the women's tribunal be a permanent tribunal, a place where women can go and seek justice in a dramatic way, in a court of a moral conscience, public conscience. Sorry. Tomorrow we have our postmortem. We have to wait and see what the 14 women's groups want to do. There are some thoughts around it, but it really means resources, Shamila. We need to make sure that there must be a secretariat, a full-time secretariat. I mean, I would love to go around the country with a crew, with a video camera, with all the equipment to start talking to women outside of the Klang Valley. Yes, we went as far as Sarawak, we went as far as Terengganu and Kelantan, but really there are many women we have not reached. It'll be great if the Women's Tribunal actually had a permanent secretariat going out to seek these testimonies, to really to show the cabinet, to show parliament, the authorities who are in power, what the reality of women's lives are. And the only way you're going to be convinced is when you hear it from the women themselves, from their voices.
Ivy, thanks for speaking with us.
All of the air. Thank you for having me.
That was Ivy Jesiah, convener of the Women's Tribunal Malaysia, speaking to us about what lies ahead, what needs to be done. Do share your thoughts with us. What are the biggest issues facing women here in Malaysia? You can call 7732900, WhatsApp 018-789-8899, tweet us at BFM Radio.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.